Namo dasa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhasa. Namo dasa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhasa. Namo dasa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhasa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang Namasami. So, greetings, everyone. Welcome to another Wednesday evening with the Clear Mountain Monastery community. This evening, I'll be continuing to speak about and try to wrap my mind around and to summarize and just digest my whole experience at Dharma Realm Buddhist University, a Mahayana university in Ukiah, California, where I have been attending school for the last 4 years, university program. So, the topic of tonight's discussion will be attachment to, in parentheses, right views, attachment to right views. And by that, I do kind of mean Theravada views, and I'll explain that a little bit more. But just to give people who, if this is your first time coming to the channel, the formats for these Wednesday evenings is that I'll give some reflections about a particular theme, and then around 6:30, so after half an hour or so, open things up to questions so people can put questions or thoughts, reflections in the comments on YouTube or on Facebook at any time. So, attachment to right views. This is something which I came face to face with during my first semester 4 years ago at Dharma Realm Buddhist University, which is affiliated with. It's actually the school itself is inside of the City of 10,000 Buddhas, a Chinese Mahayana monastery in the tradition of Master Xunhua. The first semester was mostly Theravada, and I was super into it. And I think they could tell that maybe by my outfit, but there was just a recognition that, and that's generally the program. They start off with Theravada texts, these early Pali texts, and then maybe three quarters of the way through that first semester, they introduce some Mahayana text. And I was surprised to notice my level of attachment, my kind of uncomfortability reading about certain Mahayana concepts, which seemed to, in my understanding of them at that time, and still partially at this time, was a bit triggered. I couldn't figure out how to reconcile these two different, seemingly different views of the world. Were they actually different? Are they the same and I'm just misunderstanding them? Are they the same and we're just looking at different aspects of the same thing? And I'm just looking at it from a different way. So seeing my own attachment to right views was not part of the curriculum necessarily. There's not a class on attachment to right or wrong views. It was more of a like an epiphenomenon. So I'm seeing my own attachment. I love Theravada. I love Pali. And just being put, encountering these different texts that I wasn't so familiar with, kind of brought this up, and it manifested in kind of a tension in the face, tension in the shoulders, and I could feel it in the way that I would be interacting with others. I'm not really listening as well. I'm just waiting to say my point and kind of steaming and fuming that they've got it wrong and I know it's right. I'm a monk and I've been a monk for however long and it's like this and they don't really know what's going on. So those are all the kind of ideas that are stirring in my head at the time. So I get a lot of opportunities to look at that through the years because you have Buddhist classics once every other semester, but it's kind of really a part of the fabric of the whole educational framework there. So about 2 weeks ago, right after I graduated from the program, the very next day, I went back to my home monastery where I ordained Abhayagiri. And it was either that morning or the following morning, just sitting in meditation, this thought arose, which I think is a really good koan for me, and I think for a lot of people. And that's this subtitle here of how can I make my Theravada a Mahayana? And by that, I don't mean, forcing myself to believe things which say are in the Mahayana canon, maybe not in the Theravada canon, or forcing myself to save all living beings before I attain arhatship or something like that. But how can I make my Theravada a big vehicle, a maha, large, expansive yana vehicle? And by that I mean, something, a vehicle, a religion, a life philosophy, a practice that I can live with and that can encompass all the different aspects of all the wholesome aspects of my being that I can't just wipe away. So I'm not trying to excuse any of my bad habits or anything, but there, all of us have deep underlying tendencies, and some of those need to manifest. That's why I went to the university. Going to university is not a normal thing for a forest monk, but for me, I love to study, and there doesn't have to be anything wrong with that. The Buddha praised ones who are bahu sutta, ones who have heard a lot, or the quality of being sutta, S-U-T-A, that is having much learning. And the Buddha said this is a cause for pamoja, or well-being. And this is an aspect of a great vehicle in the sense that I'm speaking is that perhaps a dry insight, sukha vipassaka, S-U-K-K-A, like a dry insight approach to meditation where you don't have any happiness, well-being is not a part of your path. Maybe that works for some people. If you can attain arhatship in this life by experiencing, if your capacity for your patient endurance can do that, then all the best to you. But not all of us have the same level of patience, and finding what works for us, what is a sustainable vehicle, that's a Mahayana. And for me, that includes study. That's why I went to a Burmese monastery 5 years ago to experiment with what having a full-on group schedule of meditation is like. So in Thai forest tradition, where I ordained and where I've lived most of my monastic years, really emphasizes practice in seclusion. So you eat the meal together, but then you go back to your hut and meditate by yourself. So part of me is wondering, how does group practice support my life? How can group practice be a part of my vehicle? And it really does help. And all of us need to experiment with all these rather allowable ways of, making our vehicle livable. Once Ajahn Panya Vado, a great forest monk, disciple of Ajahn Mahabua, a British person, was once asked, what is the difference, or why would someone practice the Mahayana rather than the Theravada? And he gave this really, I think, beautiful simile, which is, the Mahayana is basically you're making a cruise ship for crossing the river. And whereas for him, he felt that the Buddha just said, all you need to do is cobble together a few boards, you just find some wood on the beach and then cobble it together, and you just need a raft just to get you to the other side of the river. You don't need a whole yacht. And a Mahayana, in his perspective, is you're building paramis for basically infinite lives, it seems. You're building your capacity to give anything, give your limbs, give your life, give the lives of the people around you. So practicing generosity to its utmost degree, practicing patience to its utmost degree, whereas in the Theravada approach, it's just do what needs to be done. You don't need a bigger ship than you need. But the question then comes, well, what if my raft needs to be bigger than the raft that I've currently cobbled together? And you see this, you see people, it's almost a pattern. You see people come to the monastery and their practices are very dry. It seems like they have no healthy sense of Dhamma nourishment in their lives, no Dhamma piti in their lives. They don't basically they've gone to a meditation retreat. This happens especially with Westerners. Go to a meditation retreat. It's your first introduction to Buddhism. And you think this is the only path, this meditation, just need to do meditation all the time. And that can be a path for some people, but certainly not the majority of people. Probably not even, well, yeah, try it out for yourself. What do you really need? And then making your raft accordingly, because you don't want to get halfway across the stream and realize that your raft is breaking apart and then you just get swept away with the current. So that pattern I was saying at the monastery is people come, they're super inspired, they meditate more than everybody else, and they meditate more publicly than everybody else. They're always in the hall meditating, and it's inspiring, but it oftentimes doesn't last. I was in that mode, and sometimes it can be fueled by a lot of aversion or a lot of views, actually. So all that to say, how questioning oneself, how can I make my Theravada a adequate, expansive, sustainable vehicle? Because it's possible, friends and venerables, that arhatship might not be as soon coming as you hope, and having a steady and reliable and healthy sense of well-being along the path will nourish you. That's, you know, some wrapping around your dry boards. So I will go into certain aspects of Theravada and Mahayana, which were somewhat triggering for me. But first, I would like to introduce what I'll frame as a spoiler. So this is, I think, quite a practical way to deal with and relate to attachment to views as they come up. So I'm specifically talking about attachment, my own attachment, and I see it in others, to some specific idea of a Theravada right view. Or this could be your views about politics. Your Republican friend comes over, a relative comes over, and you're a Democrat. How do you relate? Or your Democrat comes over, your Democrat relative comes over, and you're Republican. How do you relate to your own views around this? And I think this quote, which comes up many times and is actually part of the jhana formula for the attainment of, or the experience of, boundless space, the akasanjayatana meditative experience, but it contains a few very useful clues that you can use right now to let go of attachment in different ways. When you can see that attachment isn't useful, when I latch on and say, only this is true and everything else is wrong, then, and I force that perspective, steamrolling other people, not listening to the friends and family around me, it's unhealthy and it sucks and it's anxiety inducing and it's ugly. You've seen it in other people when they attach to their views and they stop listening to you. And if there was a mirror around and you could see yourself, you'd probably see the ugliness of it. It crumples the brow and does weird things to the mouth and kind of disables the capacity for laughter, which is unfortunate. But here we have three specific clues on what to do when attachment to views comes up, which I've used with relationship to my love of Theravada and when that manifests as an unhealthy attachment. So with the settling of perceptions of conflict or aversion, this is patiga sanya atangama. So atangama, literally, it means the settling down or the attenuation, or it literally means the going home. With the going home of patiga sanya, perceptions, patiga, usually translated as conflict or obstruction. So if you're entering on to the attainment of empty space, then you let go of perceptions of obstruction, that there is an end to this form. There's just space is what you're entering into. But patiga can also mean aversion. So an aversion, in my experience, is totally wrapped up with my attachment to views. It's that I love my views and I hate your views. If you are whatever person who's kind of piqued my ire and triggered my Theravada sensitivities. So letting this aversion go home, perceptions of aversion go home, leave, settle down. relaxing the face, not focusing on perceptions of diversity. That's nanatta sanya amanasikara. So amanasikara, kara, the turning or the movement of the mana, the mind, so not turning the mind to the sanya, perceptions of nanatta. Difference. Is there really that big a difference between this perception and that perception? And maybe there is. Maybe there is, but do I have to pay attention to it? And when I'm fixated on my own views, then I become unable to I become hyper-focused on distinctions and differences. So what this is doing is saying, can I not focus? Can I just not look at, not attend to, not mentally engage with perceptions of difference? Are we really that different? And that can be a really helpful perception. Just, yeah, really, we're humans. And can I pay attention to what we have in common? Aging, sickness, and death. We're gonna die. This conversation is not gonna matter. I won't remember it in a week unless I'm stupid and say something idiotic based on my attachment. So another good tool. Do I have the flexibility, and can I incline towards the flexibility that doesn't focus on diversity? So ananta akaso, so aware that space is unbounded. One enters upon and abides in the expanse of boundless space. So entering in and abiding, it just sounds so much more comfortable, just relaxing all of this difference making, the us and them, me and you, Democrat, Republican, Theravada, Mahayana. I don't have to focus on that. There probably are significant and useful things to acknowledge about differences, but when my face contracts and my shoulders get all up here and my heart begins to beat and I stop being able to laugh and smile and listen, then can I pay attention to the expanse of boundless space? So this is sometimes framed as the attainment of infinite space. Literally, it is akasanchayatana, ayatanam. So ayatana, oftentimes translated as sphere, but it literally means an expanse of ananta, or antas are boundaries or limits, and ananta is boundlessness, limitlessness, the expanse of limitless akasa, space, entering in and abiding in that. And you can do that on a physical level. When the forehead is contracting, just seeing, can the musculature in my face and shoulders and hands just expand outwards and frontwards and upwards in any direction other than just contracting inwards? So that was the spoiler. And you can do that anytime, especially as we go along. If I say something's triggering, that's actually just realizing this is, what does the word triggering mean, or to be triggered? It is in certain, when it's being applied to one's opinions or hearing other people speak, it is pointing to an attachment to views. So we'll just go into different areas of apparent Theravada and Mahayana doctrinal difference. When I say apparent, I don't mean that they don't exist, but I'm not sure in all these instances if there actually is that much difference. there are differences in the portrayal of the Buddha, differences in the portrayal of the Dhamma, of the ideal Sangha, of what the path looks like towards that ideal, and of what it looks like in these different contexts. And it is based on a kind of an interesting list by John Kohler, who's a professor at Columbia. And I've edited it slightly and give my own commentary, but he provided a bit of the inspiration there. You can find some of his work online. So the first question is, who is the Buddha? So in a Theravada context, it's pretty clear. from a Western perspective and from the perspective of the oldest Pali texts, the Buddha was a human. He was born in his mother's womb, from his mother's womb, and grew up as a human. He wasn't super abnormally big. He wasn't a god. He wasn't a yucca. He wasn't immortal. He died. He walked India. You can go and walk where he walked. He was a human. And he attained enlightenment through his own efforts and efforts that we can emulate when we follow his path. So that's the Theravada perspective. And for many of us, especially convert Buddhists, we find that really inspiring. We can do it. The Buddha did it. So can we. In Mahayana, we have different conceptions of the Buddha. Basically, what's called the Trikaya doctrine or the three-body doctrine. You might consider it three-body problem, but that's only if you're leaning in that direction. But the three-body doctrine, which comes up in the Ashta Sahasrika Prajnaparamita Sutra of the Mahayana canon, basically talks about three types of Buddha. So you've got the transformation Buddha, or the Nimanakaya, which is the manifestation of a Buddha. So Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical Buddha that we think of in the Theravada context and is acknowledged in the Mahayana, was this Nirmanakaya transformation. So this is a human embodied form of the Buddha. The second is the enjoyment body, or the Sambhogakaya, which is in the Mahayana. You have all these different types of different Buddhas, actually, who are dwelling contemporaneously with us. So you've got Amitabha Buddha in the Western Pure Land. You've got Samantabhadra Buddha. You've got all of these different Buddhas who are sometimes called Buddhas, sometimes called Bodhisattvas. Manjushri Buddha, Bodhisattva, are somewhat celestial Buddhas is another translation. And when I was first encountering this, I was a bit confused. I mean, doesn't it say in the Pali Canon, it does, that only one Buddha can appear at one time in a world system? So how does that square with there being infinite Buddhas, which you find in the Avatamsaka Sutra, the Lotus Sutra, many Mahayana Sutras, just infinite of these celestial Buddhas, these Sambhogakaya Buddhas. And then the Dharmakaya is just, the word does come up in the Pali Canon and the Digha Nikaya, but it comes to mean this, the Tathagata Garbha or the Buddha nature, which I'll probably talk about in another talk, which is somewhat triggering as well, the concept of Buddha nature. But when one reads about this Dharmakaya or Tathagata Garbha or Buddha nature, it can seem for a Theravada person like this is pointing to a capital B Brahma. This is all existence embodied in a human, or embodied in a Buddha, which doesn't die, isn't born, etc. And when you talk about things not being born, not dying, the only context that you find that in a Theravada context in is as Nibbana. So anything that's not anicca is not Nibbana is suspect from a Theravada point of view. So I'm being triggered as I read about these things. So who is the Buddha is triggering. So as I go along, I'll be introducing Theravada quotes that help us relax our views and kind of settle back into this settling down of perceptions of aversion. So this is from the Majjhima Nikaya 8, the Effacement Sutta, which is great. I'll be quoting it a number of times tonight, I think. So it's a great sutta. Mahachunda comes and asks, many various views arise in the world concerned with doctrines of the self in the world, or one could say the Buddha. How does a mendicant who is focusing on the starting point give up and let go of these views? And the Buddha answers, a mendicant gives up and lets go of these views by truly seeing with right wisdom where they arise, that is upajanti, where they settle in, anusinti, that means where they kind of get under your skin, where they embed themselves, and where they act up, where they sumudha charenti. So if one is practicing embodiment and you can feel your face contracting. You can feel your shoulders getting tight. Then that's the beginning. And you can relax them right there. This is not mine. This physical tightening is not mine. It's not, I am not this. This is not myself. And the view which is causing this on a certain level is, this is not mine. This, I am not this. This is not myself. I don't have to pick it up in this particular way. So relating to these different ideas of the Buddha in that way. So what is the Dhamma? You talk about this in many ways, but you know, the Tipitaka in the Pali Canon is a different collection of suttas in a number of ways than the Tripitaka of the Chinese canon. So the Tipitaka was basically set around, say, 300 years after the Buddha. The Melinda Panhas sneaks in there, but it was basically canonized with only minor, very minor differences in Burma. The Burmese edition, Sri Lankan edition, Thai editions are all very, very similar. With the Chinese Tripitaka, you have multiple editions based on the emperor who is codifying and canonizing the different texts. So different texts and ones which go, so the Six Patriarch Sutra is a sutra, and it was, you know, written by or composed around and about the Six Patriarch, who was, I believe, maybe 6th century, 7th century AD in China. So the Chinese canon extends much further historically than the Pali canon does. So how do I relate to this? I'm very comfortable with the Pali canon presenting a picture of the historical Buddha, but not so much with certain things than the Tripitaka. So another entrance from the Pali canon, we've got talk of attachment, ways of attaching to views. So one is this trope of only this is true and everything else is wrong. And one is this idea of holding on to views and not relinquishing them easily. So this pericope or stock phrase, which comes up in, I think, 80 different places in the canon, is one obstinately sticks to what one knows, what one has known and seen and understood for oneself, insisting that only this is true, anything else is wrong. And this is characterized by the Buddha as being an attachment to views in one thing, something which is not to be done. So if the Buddha says it's not to be done and characterizes it and says it's foolish, then maybe I can chill out. And then the second pericope is this one in the Salaka Sutta again, Majjhima number 8, where the Buddha says, the mind should be inclined thus, others will adhere to their own views, hold on to them tenaciously, and relinquish them with difficulty. But we won't do that, but we'll be able to relinquish our views easily. In the Pali is fun, Sanditi Paramasi Adana Gahi Dupati Nisagi. So do I have to do that with my views of Theravada and Mahayana? Another view is what is the ideal or the Sangha? And so you've got the Arhat ideal versus the Bodhisattva ideal. And you actually do have, our heroes, Sariputra and other Arhats from the Pali canon, really seen as playing the part of almost a buffoon. At least that's my reading of it. Suttas like the Vimalakirti Sutta, you've got Sariputra just acting with very little wisdom. And that's, for someone who loves the Pali canon, that's hard to read. So more quotes from the Pali canon encouraging me to just not make a problem out of it. You know, if it's an authentic sutra, which most or many Mahayana practitioners believe these sutras are, the Lotus Sutra, the Vimalakirti Sutra, people believe that's historical. I don't have to make a problem of it, whether it is or it is not. And is there good Dhamma there? Maybe I'm just not seeing it from the right angle. So this is just a cool stock phrase from Majjhima number 2, where the Buddha talks about speculative views being a thicket of views, a wilderness of views, a contortion of views, and a vacillation and a fetter of views. So just a great imagery around how it feels internally. I mean, our musculature does this. It gets all tight and wound up around our views. And our lives and our relationships get all tied and wound up around this thicket of what we think is true. Only this is true and everything else is wrong. Candidate X is just a completely wrong for the country, and candidate Y is totally right. Only this is true, everything else is false. Theravada is always true, Mahayana is always false. It can be a wilderness and a thicket. It doesn't mean you don't have to have views, but you don't have to hold on to them in a way which brings turmoil, strife to you and your relationships and your mind. The path, you've got the Eightfold Path, very clear in a Theravada context, and the paramitas, basically this idea of dharma doors are infinite. I vow to cultivate them all. Living beings are numerous. I vow to save them all. Vow. How do you do that? It just seems, I can't get my mind around it. So, relax. And faith. Kama, I am the owner of my kama, heir to my kama, born of my kama, whatever I do, for good or for ill, of that I am the heir. That's Theravada right view. And there are ways of reading Mahayana sutras, which I think are easy interpretations, actually, that if you just pray, what's called intercessory prayer, just if I just pray or say this Bodhisattva or Buddha's name enough, then they'll come and save me from whatever is going on. And in my last talk on Guanyin Buddha, I talked about ways that it could be held in a healthy way, which doesn't give up your agency, but I think it is dangerous. And holding on, yeah, recognizing that danger, recognizing right view as right view and wrong view as wrong view, but not making a problem out of it, and being able to talk about it in a way which you can listen and learn from other people. And so finally, at the end of the Salaika Sutta, the Buddha encourages all of us, because it's a sutta not just about relinquishing views, but all sorts of bad habits and cultivating meditation. And at the Buddha end, the Buddha says, gives us great advice, what should be done for his disciples out of compassion by a teacher who seeks their welfare out of compassion. That's a very Mahayana concept. It's Theravada as well. And has compassion for them, that I've done for you. There are these, I don't have it here, but there are these roots of trees. Meditate. Here it is, yeah. There are these empty huts. Meditate. Do not delay, or else you will regret. This is our instruction to you. So it's in the plural, suggesting perhaps that's what all Buddhas say, which is a very Mahayana perspective. So with that, open things up to everyone. I hope I didn't trigger anyone, or if I did, I hope you were able to relax around it, and we'll just go to questions. Thank you for enduring that, if it was, excitatory in an unhelpful way. Okay. Dear Ajahn, please help me. I have no communication with Dhammadharini. I need some sort of communication, as my life is not a worldling. Okay. Dhammadharini is a very nice bhikkhuni monastery, and you could email them. I believe their email address is on the website. So that would be my first place to check. I'll see some of them on Friday and then again on Sunday. I think you communicating would be the best idea there. Okay. Thanks, Ajahn, for helping broaden the spiritual path for many. Yeah, I think this is a really useful koan for people. How can I make, if you are Theravada-ly inclined, which I am, and I think many of you are, how can you make your Theravada a Mahayana, a great vehicle, an expansive vehicle, a sufficient vehicle, a sustainable vehicle for the river that we're crossing, the river of samsara? Someone brings up a question about the jhanas. So yeah, the jhanic attainment of infinite space is different from the perception that I was pointing out, and that's important to know. I'm not saying that, that perception can go into a jhanic attainment, and that's the typical way of speaking and framing that formula that I presented at the beginning. But it is also just a perception that one can cultivate. Okay. So I've studied these differences, and I think it's simply a matter of historical development, not so much main ideas or teachings. Yeah, I think that is largely my perspective as well. There are some wordings which I think are useful to speak more about and go into. I don't think we'll have time in this video, but which do seem to be pointing perhaps to something different. But I think it's largely a matter of vernacular and historical development. So yeah, good point. So someone points out one teaching Buddha. I'm not sure exactly what this is pointing to, but in the Theravada perspective, it said that in one kappa, I believe an eon, there can only be one Buddha who appears. So in the Theravada perspective, that was Shakyamuni Buddha 2,600 years ago. And then we'll have to wait for Maitreya Buddha, in the next kappa or when he comes. So next point. When I studied Theravada, Abhidhamma, the main Mahayana teachings or Sunyata or Alaya Vijnana are present in there, just in different formulation. I think that is a possible perspective. And yeah, certainly Sunyata or emptiness does occur in the canon, and the Buddha does talk about it. It's just elaborated upon to an extremely extensive degree in the Mahayana. And the Alaya Vijnana, the storehouse consciousness, is not mentioned by name in Theravada Abhidhamma. That's probably for another video. It's possible that Doug's Dharma has a video on Alaya Vijnana, but that's too much for this context tonight. I'm going to look for some people who haven't. Okay. So I often remind myself that if those views, regardless of how different from mine, help them cultivate the wholesome and abandon the unwholesome, then what is the problem aside from personal opinions? Yeah, the Buddhist path is largely a pragmatic one, and you really put your finger on exactly the pragmatic question. What, when I do it, will lead to the arising of wholesome dhammas and to the decrease of unwholesome dhammas? What, when I do it, will lead to my long-term welfare and happiness? And it might be the case that sometime later down the line, one does for one's insights into the truth of anatta, if one wants to go deeper into that, have to question a lot of these things, the questioning can be done in a lighthearted and not superficial, but not super tight way. So very good point, very good touchstone. The Buddha did not mince words with regards to wrong path chosen by other sect leaders, as evidenced by the Anattapindika Sutta. Also, he warned about the corruption of the Dharma. And then there's a dash, Mahayana. He did talk about corruption of the Dhamma, talking about a Dhamma, that a Dhamma would appear in the world. He does not mention the Mahayana as being exactly what that is. There are teachers, one of whom I really know and respect, who does, I think he has said or written that he believes that the arising of the Prajnaparamita literature was, which says, as I talked about in an earlier video, there is no Four Noble Truths, basically. There is no dukkha, there is no cause of dukkha, there's no cessation, there's no path. This author says that is a Dhamma, and from his perspective is the arising of the corruption of Dhamma. You're right, there is at least one sutta where the Buddha says that from time to time it is appropriate to speak with wanderers of other sects about their wrong views, but that's only if there's an opening. When the Buddha is talking to Bhaka, the Brahmin, basically, or he's got some sutta to a Brahmin, discourse to a Brahmin, where he says, the views of other people are their views, and I just don't pick them up and I won't try to mangle that quote, But I think what you're pointing to is useful, that there is a place for certainly clarity around right view. There is, it's the Noble Eightfold Path, right view, right, et cetera, right intention all the way down the line. There is right view, there is right view. But to hold only this is true and everything else is false in this tight and unhelpful way, this is the fetter of views. The Buddha talked about the dit asava, the outflow or the inflow of views. He talked about the dit oga, the over flooding of views. He talked about the dit anusaya, the underlying tendency of views. He talked about the ditta gunti, the tangle of views, the ditti jala, the net of views. So he talks all over the place about ways that we can trap ourselves. So how do we do this? Navigate a very extremely clear and pristine and accurate view of what is right view that the Buddha taught, but then not getting our britches all crumpled or our monk skirts, monk trousers, monk underwear, monk undergarments, all up in a knot about it. Okay. Good point. We need constant reminders to not cling to views in general. Yes, so true, so true. And I was mentioning a political context. It can also, it just crops up in just all of our relationships. Basically, it's so sad that it's oftentimes this attachment to views that spoils and ruins and corrupts our closest relationships. And oftentimes the differences are so minor that we fight about, you know, which way to put the forks and the knives in the dishwasher, which way, you know, how to make the bed, where to throw the laundry, et cetera. And this is an essential skill, not just for Buddhists, but for humans, if you're going to have long lasting and enduring relationships, because our attachment to views can often just ruin them and run roughshod over the things that we care about most. So great point. Would love to see Jason Quinn on your YouTube as a guest speaker. He's a Zen teacher, and I think he could answer a lot of questions. Yeah, that would be interesting, especially if he, you could email clearmountainmonastery@gmail.com if you have some kind of connection with him, and especially if he knows Theravada. So I've got a number of Mahayana acquaintances, some of whom are quite versed in the Theravada, but what I find most helpful is if someone is versed both in textual Mahayana and Theravada and practical or meditative Theravada and Mahayana, the latter of which one can make a extremely good case. You know, they is not that different, but oftentimes the language, if they don't know the language, the vernacular of the Theravada, then it's extremely easy to just talk past one another. This might be the last question for tonight. Did you find any Mahayana students at the university who were surprised or otherwise at the views held in Theravada? Oh, totally. Yeah, totally. I mean, people going to this university are self-selecting. I mean, they either don't know much about Mahayana or they're already Mahayana inclined and don't know much at all about Theravada. So when I kind of voiced my Theravada supremacist views, which is what happens when I become attached to views, then they're surprised and really taken aback and they say, oh yeah, I did. And it was ugly. It was ugly when I, if I ever got into, the kind of mental, unbeautiful dance with them. So, well, we might have to call that an evening, with questions, an evening just here on YouTube, but we will go over to, Zoom where it can be a more interactive experience, and I'll put the link in the chats there. So you can just go over there and I'll look forward to hearing people's perspectives. It's obviously a very rich conversation that is useful to have. And Grateful for everyone's perspectives, and we'll look forward to seeing people over there on Zoom. Ayaz, Nyanika, and Subijana will be at St. Mark's this Saturday. Ajahn Nisimbo and I are both still in California at that time. But I'll be moving up to Seattle next week. So hope to see any of you that are up there. And wish you all the best and look forward to seeing those of you who join on Zoom. Okay. Have a good evening, everyone.